3,043 square feet. In 2007, the appraisal showed 3,058. It was 3,058 exactly, not 3,058 and a half. And the 2014 appraisal showed 3,163. This must have really been traumatic to have these numbers down the way you have them here. And so in 2014, it showed 3,163 square feet, even though the most recent owner added a bonus room of 272 square feet. So has the method changed? Or was that really 272 square feet? Are you sure it wasn't 260 and a half? What about the difference between 3,043 square feet and 3,058 square feet? Is there a vast appraiser conspiracy?
Who cares?
Okay, all right.
I'm sorry, that was not an appraiser speaking.
I apologize. Me. I apologize for Lynn already, okay?
That is an appraiser.
What about the difference between 3,043 or 3,058 and 3,163, even though the sellers put in an addition of a bonus room for 272 square feet?
Well, number one, you'd have to see the property to
right.
see where that bonus room is, if it's got an angled roof line, whether they measured from the base or if they measured from the inside, if there's the angles. The other differences could be your tape stretches out over time, and we tape the ends when it rips. I mean, I'm trying to be as honest, you know, from an appraisal standpoint.
Well,
the house shrunk.
Is there some secret way that appraisers have for measuring gross living area?
No, there's the ANSI standards, which is all I know is by ANSI's. It's an American National Builders. But anyway, it's a voluntary standard.
Here, I'm going to give you a demonstration. This will allow you to remember this, okay? Mr. Hamlet, will you please stand? This is the square footage method for calculating. The American National Standards Institute, this is their standard, and this is Swain Hamlet. Swain was the National Association of Realtors representative.
And still am.
To the American National Standards Institute for the development of this standard. So if you've got a bitch about it, this is the man, okay? All right? All right, thank you very much, Swain.
And remember, I'm 5 feet 16 inches, and I can do it all. I did this for all the realtors in the United States. I'm one of 9 consensus members of this board. There's no excuse you don't know how to measure properly.
Where can they get that? No, you're right. Where can we get that?
Okay.
May I repeat that? He said it's only $40, you can afford that. Comment was, I don't know, they can't give $15 to RPAC. I couldn't pass that up. Thank you for the opening. Atta boy.
All right, good. Thank you, Swain.
Me too.
Thank you for your service.
So, above grade, below grade, that seems to be one of the issues that a lot of us have issues with. As long as we're talking about how do we come up with square footage, do you want to speak for a second?
Yeah, and before you do that, because I've got another part to this question here, and that had to do with, I must have not liked that person. I threw that question away.
They wouldn't return your phone call last week?
No. But it had to do with bedrooms in the basement, bedrooms and baths in the basement. And I did have this question here, and I really didn't throw it away. But I think it kind of goes the same way, like bonus room, breezeway, what else do they call them? Sun rooms, plant rooms, spa rooms, enclosed swimming pools are the other ones. Shouldn't that be part of what can you tell us about below-grade living area and these bonus room things, or where I come from, with Florida rooms?
Okay, well, yeah, I come from cold country, so. For the basement area, again, it depends on access, ingress, egress. I know that when you look to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, they talk about above and below grade living area, and theirs is, you know, like a tri-level or a bi-level or something like that, that you should put the lower level in the basement area. You can adjust it dollar for dollar the same as you would above grade, but that you look at it separately. And then there's the little unless. And the unless is if your market perceives that as actual living area, and that's the way that buyers are buying and sellers are selling it, then make sure you're comparing from an appraisal standpoint apples with apples.
Right.
You only get in trouble when you make a fruit salad and you use different kind
you use different kind of comparables.
The different kind of sale properties, because they're not comparable. And so that's one way you get in trouble. Some of the other homes that have the walkout backs, you know, from the front they look like ranch style houses, and from the back they look like two stories, and they're built usually on golf courses or with very nice views if you live in an area that you have views. And that way, this is where you might differ from the ANSI standards, and I mean no disrespect to ANSI, but from an appraiser standpoint, we might be looking at actual living area and adding 8 to 12 inches for the wall so that we're consistent with our square footage and including that in our gross living area. I caution, if you're reading an appraisal report or if you're doing an appraisal report, if you're using something that's not the norm, explain it. Use comparables that are similar to it and be able to defend it because it's your opinion of value. And again, you have to look to what your particular markets are doing. And that's from a real world appraisal standpoint.
Thanks. Yeah, that is great. And I guess what we need to point out, the American National Standards Institute method or standards is a voluntary standard. It has been adopted by the legislatures or the appraisal boards in a couple of states. I know Kentucky for sure and North Carolina. They recognize it. And I know in Kentucky they require the appraisers to comply with the ANSI standard. At the very least, I think it is important for you to take a look at it because I don't know anybody that doesn't use it, even when it's not required, as a general guideline related to ceiling height or the percentage of the room, which is over, 5 feet? 5 feet. The slope on the walls, and for below grade area, which is heated and cooled. Also, for access to areas which may be detached from the main living area. There's some great information in that ANSI standard, and it will help you understand things. The other thing I think that is important is that I don't know that there is a vast conspiracy amongst appraisers to consistently lowball properties or treat properties that have below-grade living area differently. Their requirement is essentially to test the market, as Maggie's talking about. That's what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac want the appraiser to do. Just because an area is below grade does not mean it's worthless. Right. It just means that Fannie Mae says it's not gross living area. Right. That doesn't mean that you pretend like it's not there. Unfortunately, I've run across plenty of appraisers that just pretend it's not there. And it could be that's where the master bedroom is, like was mentioned in this question that I found again. Where the master bedroom is, where the most elaborate bathroom is, where the home office is, where the home theater is.
The kitchen.
It could be the kitchen. It could be the most valuable room in the house, the most nicely finished room in the house, but it's below grade. That just means it's not included in gross living area, but the appraiser should be making market-extracted adjustments for that below-grade living area. Okay, so we don't get too far off track. I'm going to ask that we have our NAR players come up and present.
Hey, Frank, before we move on, I just want to make one more point.
Please.
If that's okay, and it's related to competency. We talked in this skit specifically about geographic competency And I think it's critical that we define that holistically. An appraiser should be competent to appraise a property. And that could be the type of property it is, its location, any number of things. But it's oftentimes, as I've attended many of these conferences, it seems like we're so focused on the geographic element of competency that we're neglecting other pieces. And it's critical that we look at it holistically. The appraiser's job, as Maggie has so nicely articulated, is to look at a property holistically, look at the data, utilize her experience, her contacts, her network to ultimately arrive at her at the market value. So I think that that's just clarification I wanted to add in.
Good.
There.
And I'll just thank you for bringing that up, Ryan. The other thing is I'll say is that competency is not determined by proximity.
Correct.
It is possible for folks to be geographically competent, yet live several hundred miles away, maybe have an office several hundred miles away. It's also possible for people to not have geographic competency, yet their office is within three blocks of the property.
Right. So
proximity doesn't do it. Competency is determined by knowledge, ability, expertise, and experience.
Wonderful.
And I want to piggyback real quick. I know that we've been talking here about appraisers doing appraisals, but I want to throw in here as the primary author of the BPOR course, many of you in this room are doing BPOs on properties. We are bound by the same requirements of geographic competence when we're doing a BPO that the appraisers are when they're doing an appraisal. And when we go too far out of our area of competence on BPOs, we are messing up those distressed property sales something fierce. And that's not okay either. And I always marvel at the realtors who think the appraisers shouldn't do it, but yet they're traveling all over the place doing it themselves. So we need to be just as cognizant of any time you're doing a, and we don't do appraisals, but a price evaluation of any kind, that there has to be competence there. So, we ready to do this? Last one?
Last one. Yeah.
All right.
Before they get started, I was just reminded, go, you can stay there. The code of ethics was just, Article 11? Yeah. I can't remember.
11. We changed 11.
Was just a change to address that very fact. And I have to tell you that when I get on sites like ActiveRain and so on, and I read about people bitching about the other agents doing BPOs, I do chuckle.
No, and you should, because we're pointing the fingers at you
right
and doing it ourselves. So you got a point there. All right, we got a problem. Now I'm a buyer this time, so you'll know.
I'm the poor agent. Listen to the buyer.
All right, it didn't appraise. It didn't appraise out, and the lender's telling me I have to come up with additional funds to pay the difference between the contract price and what it appraised for, because he won't let me have my mortgage.
Well, the first step is to have your lender contact the appraiser, and we submit the information to support a higher price if we have it. If it is still coming in under the sales price, we might have to talk to the sellers, do some renegotiating. If not, and the seller says, no, thank you, then we might have to put the house back on the market.
Well, can't we just call the appraiser and tell him the appraisal's too low and maybe we can convince him that he missed something?
Well, unfortunately, we cannot call the appraiser directly after the appraiser has completed the report and sent it to the lender.
Well, one of my friends had this happen when she was buying a house. She tried to contact her lender, and the lender said there wasn't anything they could do, told her to call the appraisal management company, whatever that is, who ordered the appraisal. The appraisal management company told her she had to talk to the lender. All she got was the runaround. All she was trying to do was buy a house, and nobody would help her. What do we do?
Well, the appraiser's client, in most cases a lender, is responsible to deciding whether or not to require an appraiser to consider additional information. Unfortunately, there isn't a standard process for appeals across all lenders and appraisal management companies. So you may hear different stories about how an appraisal appeal was or wasn't handled.
Well, all I know is this. When I was buying the house, we looked at this. It's just so confusing. I mean, we looked at comps. You gave me comps when we put the offer in on the property, and I don't get why it doesn't appraise out. I saw the value there when I offered it. Do you think the sellers did something here? I mean, what I don't know what might be going on. Did the seller's agent meet the appraiser? Because I know you told me that's what was going to happen.
Well, I talked to the seller's agent and about what we were going through, and he was a little reluctant to take the time to meet with the appraiser at the property and seemed confused about whether or not he was allowed to talk to the appraiser. I sent the materials over to him anyway. I'll follow up with him to see if he actually met the appraiser. So, you know, just hang in there, relax. Hopefully we can get the lender to reconsider additional information and already supplied to the appraiser from that agent.
Or maybe we can get the seller to lower the price because it didn't appraise out.
Well, let's see what happens first.
Okay.
Thank you. This is good. This is I don't know where to start here.
I think
I'm going to start with Ryan, because he's already, you know, taken his penance. He asked for forgiveness because he's with an appraisal management company, and they're the ones that are probably, you know, in between in most of these cases right now. Would we agree that the best thing to do in the event there is some perceived inconsistency, some problem with the appraisal, some aspect of it is going to hamper your ability to close this transaction, probably the best thing to do is not to pick up the phone and start to read off the appraiser, to tell them what an idiot they are and how they're ruining this transaction. And as a result, they're cursed forever, and I'll see to it that you never work in this town again.
It's good we're not in New Orleans.
That's probably a bad idea for either the listing agent or the selling agent to do that.
Agreed.
Okay. But they can do that to the appraisal management company, right?
Well, there are a couple of things, and the reality is we have very stringent or strict contracts with our lender partners, our clients. And ultimately, if a borrower or a representative of a borrower were to reach out to us as an appraisal management company, we would refer them to the lender. Any of that contact needs to come to the AMC from the lender. Now, we will actively participate in it, and it's like a heavy bureaucracy, and I apologize for that, but it's in place to maintain independence. As the borrower reaches out to the lender reaches out to the AMC. The lender doesn't even reach out to the appraiser. It's the AMC that reaches out to the appraiser. We have the conversations. We may present additional data, right, facts, to that appraiser and ask them to reconsider that information as part of the report that they'd presented previously. So that's the process for reconsideration. So I think in terms of, does the AMC play a role? Absolutely, a very big role. But there are certain steps that need to be taken in order to get that involvement where it needs to be.
Okay, let me just ask this question again to help the folks here understand. That happens to be your company's a contractual agreement with lenders that you work with. Is that universal among appraisal management companies?
I believe it's consistent.
It
okay, all right.
Under that Dodd-Frankie thing.
Dottie Frank.
Okay. I would say
there are a multitude of reasons. I mean, I don't want to go too far down the legislative path, but not only Dodd-Frank, you've also got the OCC that's released third-party governance and oversight regulations. The Federal Reserve released their regulations just this past December.
Your brochure.
CFPB.
Yes.
I mean, you've got all of these federal agencies that are explaining how the job should be done because they know best. We can all agree to that, I'm sure.
And then are you being sarcastic then? That's my job.
The lenders who fall to this extreme scrutiny in the way that they're managing what is called risk with their third-party vendors, whoever that may be, in this case, an AMC. So, I mean, that's not the topic for this particular discussion, but, I mean, there are so many things that would push us in that direction, that is the appropriate path, the borrower to the lender to the AMC, and the AMC to the appraiser.
And one of the things we tried to bring out in here is that sometimes the lenders do say it's not their responsibility to do this. So we got it didn't appraise. And then the buyer's agent goes to the lender and says, we want a reappraisal, we want a reevaluation. And so, wait a minute, I shouldn't say lenders. I think it's just the loan officers sometimes that say it. I don't think they ever checked with anybody. They just, it just, we're not going to do it. And they're the ones that have to, don't they? I mean, they're the ones that have to do it.
The lenders should be doing it.
Yes.
All right. As long as we're talking about Dodd-Frank or Dodd-Frankie?
Dodd-Frankie or whatever that was.
There are three specific things in Dodd-Frank that an agent, among other people, but an agent specifically may do, right? Are there three things which are enumerated? I thought you would have them on the tip of your tongue. Mm-hmm. Correct factual errors. The agent can also ask the appraiser to consider additional comparable sales information. What's the third one? I can't remember.
Can't either. But that's all beef.
That would be a factual error.
That would be factual error. But that's beef.
No, that is after the report.
Right.
All I'm trying to illustrate here is, you know, and again, whenever you're talking about after the completion of the report, the first thing that is necessary in order for the appraiser to reconsider or to alter or to change his opinion of value is he has to first admit that he was wrong. How good are you at that? And the thing is, and I'd say most appraisers do their darndest to make sure that they're not wrong when they submit the report.
Yeah.
That's why I think your first and your best bet is to ask the appraiser to find a factual error in the report, whether it has to do with size, bedroom count, bathroom count, the date of some type of change, an inaccurate reported sales price on one of the comparable sales, the wrong address of one of the comparable sales, improper condition of one of the comparable sales, appraise the wrong house. That's, you know, that will always...
Which does happen.
It has happened. What about using wrong comps? If I felt that you as the appraiser didn't use the right comps, is that something that we can challenge?
What's wrong?
Exactly. It's not
that's
a factual, that's not one of the factual things, though.
That's not factual.
But if you've got a property that is comparable in nature to the subject, that may be closer in proximity, that should have been considered and it wasn't identified within the report.
Well, let's do this situation. This relates to questions that we had earlier. And that is, let's suppose, and again, I don't know about y'all's markets, but where I am right now, the preponderance of short sales and REOs has really diminished over 2014. However, in 2013, it was very common. It was just we had some markets where 40, 50, 60% of the closed transactions were distressed in some fashion, whether it's a short sale or an REO. Let's suppose that the appraiser used all short sales or all sales of REO properties as comparable sales when there were other arm's length transactions available. Is that something?
We see it as an AMC. We absolutely see when that happens, and we'll kick it back to the appraiser in those cases during our quality process and ask them to include other comparables that are not short sale or REO properties. We'll ask for numbers. We'll want to understand what percentage of their marketplace is driven by those types of properties, things of that nature. And even if it's a majority driven where it's short sale or REO, we still want at least one of those comparables to be an arm's length transaction, a standard transaction.
Okay. Anything to add to that, Penny, Maggie?
No.
Okay. Part of Dodd-Frank was an amendment to the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, ECOA. And as you know, borrowers for a residential transaction were always entitled to a copy of their appraisal, the appraisal that was considered in making the lending decision. But ECOA called for the borrower to make a request for that in writing. Mm-hmm. And although some lenders routinely made that available to the borrower, ECOA now requires that the lender make not only the appraisal, but a copy of all valuations that were considered or procured in making the lending decision. They have to be provided to the borrower no later than 3 days prior to the loan closing, and in fact, they're required to furnish it promptly. That includes appraisals, BPOs,
AVMs,
and any other thing where they come up with a new name of it that was a valuation. They have to provide that to the borrower. Both on the lending side, the appraisal management side, the agent side, and the appraiser side, are you seeing any effects of this? For you agents, are your buyers and sellers, do they need some hand-holding through reading an appraisal or reading an AVM or a BPO?
Short answer is yes, right?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. But the sellers...
We're looking for a little bit longer answer.
Okay, because the sellers aren't necessarily getting a copy of it if it appraised out. Right. Agree? I mean, it's typically the buyer gets a copy of it. I think that's why earlier we had the question, why do the appraisals all seem to come in for sales price? Because now that the buyers are automatically getting one, I think we're now seeing that it's appraising out just for the sales price, no more than that. And it may have always been doing that. I think that was the report that we got. But they do need some explanation of this. Even in our little skit, when it doesn't appraise out, we have to have an explanation. We have to make sure that they understand what's going on because they are getting a copy of it.
And one of the things that sort of exacerbated the problem is right around the same time we had to start sending them all early was when the uniform appraisal data set came into being.
And that stinks, doesn't it? Isn't that comes from somewhere from outer space. It has no relation to reality, right?
Frank, you don't like UAD, do you?
I think it's stupid.
I neither agree nor disagree with that.
Anybody
statement.
From Fannie Mae? No, it's just, they know.
Yeah, and it's caused a big problem because, you know, so much of the appraisal is
because it's stupid.
And but what starts the problem is if you look at an appraisal form, it was never intended to be read by a consumer.
Right.
It wasn't designed
wasn't intended to be read by human beings.
Once they came out with the URAR, no. It was a big marketing database.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry.
I'm sorry, I'm in the weeds here. This is all inside baseball talk.
So borrowers are confused. It's really hard to explain to them the form now, so we get a lot more calls than we ever used to.
Because you do need a translator sheet next to you to do it, right?
Right, which I'm sure you probably heard from your buyers, they're getting multiple copies of everything. And, you know, part of the issue is you have to send them the final version, which you don't know is final until it is.
So they get three final versions.
Right, mm-hmm. Because we don't want to waste time. As soon as we get the appraisal in, we send it out. It may require modifications later because of a dispute of value or reconsideration. Different or correction of typos. And we'll send out those subsequent ones. But in case we don't need a subsequent one, we don't want to have the closing delayed just because we didn't send a copy of the appraisal. So... there's two laws that kind of conflict. With Truth in Lending, you can't collect for an appraisal until roughly 10 days after application, and then you have to send it out to them 3 days before closing, which means about 7 to 10 days. So in the middle, days left, when you're writing your contracts, the fact that lenders are having to count forwards and backwards, and the different laws use different ways of counting business days. So it really leaves you about 5 to 7 days, business days, to get an appraisal done. And that's why there's so much pressure on appraisers.
The borrower can waive this right, can't they, to
in
get
writing.
As long as they get it 3 days prior to the closing. But they can waive the right to get it immediately.
They can waive the right to get it 3 days prior to closing, as long as they waive that than 3 days prior to closing, but they have to at minimum get it at consummation.
Yes. Okay. I got one other question. This was actually for Lynn, and the amendments to ECOA have had an awful lot of unintended consequences, and one of them is, at least the way it was relayed to me, and maybe Penny, you can clarify this, is that a lot of things where we don't see them, we don't envision them as being a consumer finance transaction, actually are considered by the CFPB rules related to this as a consumer finance transaction. And that would be a certain forgiveness of mortgage debt, short sales, and so on, are considered consumer finance transactions. And as a result, the borrower in these cases are given valuations, which very often do not include an appraisal, but they include AVMs and BPOs, which means, Lynn, that an awful lot of agents that did BPOs who figured no one's ever, who cares, who's ever going to see this, they actually, people are reading them.
Mm-hmm. We, and as a matter of fact, it's interesting because Ryan and I had a conversation about this, a few weeks ago. There is some discrepancy and confusion, and I think that's what we came up with, as to whether or not the BPO that I do for a short sale or whatever is going to be given to the new buyer, because I didn't do the BPO for the new buyer or for his mortgage, which is where we were coming from. But I'm telling you that a lot of the companies now, when you do BPOs, they're telling you right up front that they are going to follow those new rules, mm-hmm. and there will be a copy of the BPO you did given to the buyer who was involved in that transaction. They're erring on the side of caution, because there is a little bit of vagueness, I think you'll agree, in the new ruling on this. So yes.
So maybe agents that are doing BPOs should also err on the side of safety, in that somebody actually is probably going to read
yes.
what you did, and
yes.
They may be, you know, especially if their interests are adversely affected by what you wrote down, they're probably going to take a look at the size of your company and its assets and what kind of insurance they have when they decide what they might do about it.
Yeah.
Yep. We are starting to see that.
God, this is, I could go all day. This is just so much fun. Cocktail? Actually, I don't do cocktails. What I do are shots of tequila. That's not. That's not a cocktail. And you don't ever mix good tequila with anything. Okay. Now, you have anything to add on that? Is there anything you want to add about ECOA, the disclosure or distribution of appraisal reports and valuations prior to closing? Or
it's here.
It's here.
Be ready to answer those questions. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it would probably be wise for agents to understand, maybe your state or your local association could co-op with either an appraisal council, a local chapter of the Appraisal Institute, or the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers, and put on like a basic understanding URAR appraisal course?
Frank, the CFPB has actually put together a document that helps folks understand ECOA. And this was really designed for small companies
yes.
to be compliant with the changes. I'd recommend you can Google ECOA changes, ECOA January 2014, and you will find this document published by the CFPB. It's a Q&A. Very easy to read, very helpful, great information, and the cool thing is you're going to have to update it because there are already some rules yeah. that have changed.
Do we have a link to this on the Appraisal Insight blog or on the...
realtor.org/appraisal.
And there's a link to it there, so they don't have to Google it.
And for those of you who are BPORs, we have a webinar coming up, and I don't remember the date of it, so watch for it. Within the next few weeks, that's going to be bringing our BPORs up to date on some of these issues as well.
Great. Okay. All right. Okay. I think I got room for a couple of more questions here before Connie gives a wrap up here. And are you going to talk about evaluations? Is that something you're going to be talking? Okay. Fine. I won't talk about evaluations then. Let me ask you this about cash sales. Because I've heard conflicting things from appraisers, from lenders, and so on. But if you got cash sales, that is used as a comparable sale, first of all, would you use a cash sale as a comparable sale? Second, do you disregard or give less weight or less consideration to a cash sale as for use as a comparable sale?
Well, I hope you're talking to me.
Yes, I am. Uh-huh. Yes.
Cash is cash.
Yeah.
I mean, why would you, number one, discount cash when, you know, we're supposed to market value is, you know, cash equivalent. So if somebody's willing to give you cash,
you don't need an equivalent.
You don't need an equivalent. Yeah. So you're already starting there. So would I discount it? No. Would I be dancing all the way to the bank? Yes.
Great.
And I would use them.
All right. Well, I just looked at my clock again, and I didn't have time for two questions. I had time for that one question. So I'm going to have Connie come up here right now to close this off. But before Connie starts to speak, how about a big thanks to our panel here? Thank you an awful lot.
Thank you, Frank. I am Connie Kyle, and I'm Vice Chair of the Foreman. And first of all, I want to say thank you to all of you who have attended, but more importantly, for the thought-provoking questions that you posed to this great panel up here.
Good question.
In addition to that, I want to thank Frank. Where are you?
I'm right here.
Great job for Frank and all of the panelists, so let's give them another round of applause. And Vic, for your hard work. More importantly, let me thank the behind-the-scene people. Sarah, if you'll stand up. And Heidi, where are you? Okay. These are the people that make it all happen, so thank you. Heidi will be at the back of the room, and she'll be more than happy to accept your evaluation forms as you leave. Also, if you have any additional questions, if you will pass that on to either Heidi, Sarah, Vic, or myself, we'll see that we get answers for you. We would like to invite you to attend the committee meeting in the morning. That's at 8 o'clock right here at the Marriott in Virginia Room A and B. And my last announcement, and probably my most important, is that I would like to invite you to my great state of Louisiana for the national meeting in November. The forum will have to do with BPOs and comparative market analysis, so I know that's something that everybody is interested in. So I will end by saying I'll see you in the Big Easy.
All right.